Welcome back, Richard. It's good to see you this morning.
Good morning. Still April.
It is
April
still April.
showers. I've got some flowers coming, so I remember that. April showers bring.
Mayflowers, and it certainly has been giving us some rain here and all. But today's podcast, though, we're going to talk a little bit more about education. We're going to we started this series. I'm talking about a couple of things, and it seems like every week we think we go to the next piece, and then we realize, okay, maybe there's another piece we need to talk about next week, and another piece that we should talk about after that. And so, we're going to talk about
Yeah.
education again today.
As I was preparing this, I thought, oh, this is why people write books about this stuff, because it's such a complicated mess. And the other thing I want to say is that you and I think are I think in general we are optimists. We are not naysayers, doomsday people. But this whole thing about the plight of teachers, which is what we've been talking about, is a real serious problem. And one of the issues with this is that unless you're involved in education directly, or you're married to a teacher, or you have a family member who's a teacher, you're simply not aware of the plight of education generally, but teachers in particular. You just can't know. Even if you have children in school, you can't really appreciate the plight of teachers. And so while we don't want to throw a wet blanket on things, we'd like to bring more awareness to what our teachers are facing. Teachers are one of the most important groups in a country because they educate the next generation, or they try to educate the next generation. So it's an extremely important task that we've given them. And so we want to talk about the current plight of America's teachers. Okay. And
Hey,
there was that as we were preparing this,
yeah.
suddenly across our computers, April 4th, a couple days, 2 days ago, the Pew Research Foundation, the organization, released a study of over 2,000 teachers, asking them these questions, and the title of the article was "What's It Like to Be a Teacher in America Today?" And they had many categories of questions. In fact, this is a chap it is a small book, and it's broken into chapters. But these data give us some indication of how teachers feel about what's going on in schools today. We couldn't possibly go through all the data, but certainly a couple of things are worth mentioning. 47% of teachers say students show little or no interest in learning. They come into the building and they don't really don't care. They're really not interested in what's going on there. Okay.
Well, I thought that the really interesting ones too were like 68% of teachers say that they've experienced verbal abuse,
Right.
and 40% of teachers said that a student has been violent toward them. I
Right.
mean, this is that's wild to think about.
Right. Right. And 58% have to address behavioral issues, and we hear about that all the time, that teachers are saying, I'm having to deal with all these aggressive or all these behaviors. And then 30% are dealing with mental health issues. And so we're talking about more than half of teachers are reporting these same things. And it's made teaching an incredibly difficult job to do, okay?
Absolutely.
So in the last, we've been talking about this in the last couple of podcasts, along with efforts to improve, how do we improve? And I think this is important. How do we improve education? But also, how do we improve the plight of teachers? Because it's teachers who are delivering the education. You can't just say, we have this curriculum and anybody can present it. No, that's not going to happen. You have to have a dedicated, enthusiastic teacher who can manage all these things, who can present the curriculum that you want, whatever that curriculum is. Some teacher has to present that. So we're looking at this not only as improving education, but improving the plight of the people delivering that education.
Absolutely. And as we ended last week's episode of the podcast, we talked about the issue of school choice. We sort of introduced the idea of school choice and how there were many assumptions that came along with this idea of school choice. And that, and if we're transparent about it, there are a lot of people who continue to promote these positive assumptions about school choice. And but yet we believe that there's really important questions that need to be asked, and we really need to examine this a little bit closer. And we're going to try to do that today. But some of those fundamental assumptions is that money is attached to a child, not to a building. So when we're going to talk in a few minutes about school vouchers. And so the idea is that schools receive money, individual schools receive monies that are connected to the students that they serve. And so the school doesn't get X amount of money because it's a school. It gets X amount of money because it has X number of students, and those students are worth this amount of money. And so it kind of sounds good because you get into this whole thing with vouchers and everything. But again, we're going to talk about some of our concerns with that in just a few minutes.
Right. Yeah, so that sounds good. That part sounds good. We're gonna attach the money to the child, and then the child or the child's family can choose whatever school they want to go to. Okay. So parents then will choose, the logic continues, parents will choose safe, orderly, and high-performing schools, and they will avoid or run away from or take their children out of unsafe, disorderly, low-performing schools. That also sounds good. This idea that, well, the good schools will thrive and the poor schools will close. That sounds good, except for, the devil is always in the details, okay? And is that going to work? Well, so we said, okay, let's take those promises, money and choice, and let's see how it's working out. And
So
so,
we have three, at least three levels of school choice, right? And it is starting to expand a little bit more because school choice here, at least here in Florida, in the area that where we live, school choice includes any school. And so now the way that the system is working is that different schools offer different programs, perhaps. And so a parent whose kid is zoned for one school may put their kid on the list for a different school because that school offers a STEM program or offers, some other type of program. And so that's a form of school choice with some of the general education public schools. So that's offered. And but usually when we think about school choice, we're talking about magnet and charter schools, right?
Yeah, because we have magnet schools in Polk County. We have, I mean, most cities now, most school districts offer what are called magnet schools. And magnet, like its namesake, attract. We attract students because this school offers something of value. So it might offer science and math. It might offer technology. We have a charter school here called McKeel Academy of Technology, because when it was founded, they were going to espouse, encourage the use of technology in schools. So the idea with magnet schools is we will make underperforming schools high achieving schools. What happened instead is that we have devolved, and now we have education by lottery. Because unless you get a golden ticket, I mean, that's what we're talking about, unless you're selected for the magnet school, you can't get in. It's not like we've created enough magnet schools to satisfy the demand. We create a magnet school, but it's only going to hold a certain number of students. And so you have a lottery, and you pick a number, and if you win the lottery, you get to go to that high performing school. And if you don't, you go to your regular school. Okay.
And I think that the perfect example of where this could be right but ends up wrong is here in our district. We have schools for the arts, and so we have a particular high school that is the high school for the arts, and it is an elite school that is, you know, specific for the arts, and it offers courses and in really high level training for the most part, and great experience for kids and students who are interested in pursuing visual arts, performing arts, music, theater, all kinds of different things. To get into that school, you have to have a portfolio, you have to audition, and it is basically skills based to get into that program. And that's the way that one thinks of magnet schools to be, that, you know, we are attracting students with these specific skills so that they can focus and strengthen those specific skills. But what has happened since we have that high school is we got the interesting idea of saying, okay, let's scale that down to middle and even elementary school. And so now we have elementary schools that are schools for the arts. One would think if we were using this same model that we would have auditions for those students to get into that school, but that's not what happens. So that has become, those have become sort of elite schools where you just put your name on the list. It doesn't matter the student's level of skill with art. In fact, there are a lot of students who go to these art schools that aren't even interested in art. They only take art because they have to. But those schools are considered magnet schools, and they are considered, you know, they are considered sort of better than the other schools, better options than the other schools. And so they're schools of art, but and the students, you know, get maybe a couple of extra a little bit more time in art classes, but it's not because the students are particularly interested or more interested in artists because they won the lottery. They got their name on the list and their name was pulled, and so they get to go there.
Yeah, because they've and the other thing that it's created is that it's what I call educational elitism, because now you have these magnet schools that are set up to attract families who want to put their kids there. So they have a selective retention policy because you're here voluntarily. And if you can't handle the curriculum, if you can't do the work, or you can't behave, then this is not the school for you. And you're counseled out of that school. Okay. And so we only keep the students who fit and can do the work, which is good for the students who can do that, but bad for students who can't. And so unless you get a golden ticket and get admitted to the school, and you can do the work and you can behave, because if you become a behavior problem, then you're getting in the way and you have to be released. And magnet schools and charter schools can release students. A regular public school doesn't have that option. It's called a 0% rejection rate. No matter what the problem is, you can't deny a child an education. So the public schools, the regular public schools, have to deal with all children. Magnet schools don't. They take the students that they want. And that's why I call it educational elitism, because now we have this building filled with kids who are high achievers, high performers, and who behave themselves and whose parents are involved. Okay.
Absolutely. And now, a minute ago, you mentioned a couple of times charter schools, and you mentioned, you know, the one of the systems, charter school systems that we have here in our district. And there's actually a couple of charter school systems. When, you know, you have individual charter schools, and then we have charter school systems where there's, you know, schools at multiple levels, elementary through high school, that are all sort of in the same system. And you know, and we've mentioned this on podcasts in the past that, you know, the idea of charter schools was to create a school that was based on a particular charter, which is where they get their names. But and the charter was, we're going to explore this particular way of educating. It was, you know, we wanted to see if we could, you know, a project-based education. And so we're going to create a charter school that explores project-based education. And so they get a charter, and then they get students, and they receive monies from the state so that they can explore this. And it was meant to provide information so that we could see if there are other ways. It's almost research based. You know, are there other ways to do education that is more beneficial or more effective.
Right. Charter schools initially, when they first were sold to it, when they were first proposed, it was, well, we'll have a charter that allows us to do things that the regular schools can't do. And we will be like an educational laboratory. We will try these things. And if they work, we can export them to the public schools. But they were proposed as experimental laboratories. What they became instead was similar to magnet schools. Many of them transitioned into what I would call a magnet school. Not all of them did. There are a number of charter schools who will work hard with all students, but eventually they all have the option of counseling a child out because what we're doing here, we can't take care of you. Okay. The other issue is, do the charter schools have the same accountability as a regular public school? And many do, but not all of them do. And then the third issue is, if I have a lot of money and I want to start my own charter school, I can do that, and it's I can make money doing it.
Right.
It's the for-profit system in education, and there are many companies around the country right now who are developing magnet schools. They develop the charter and everything, but these are for-profit companies and they're making millions of dollars. And almost every day you hear about another charter school that's in legal trouble because they've been siphoning money or they've been paying for trips and using the money inappropriately or taking money that they're really not entitled to. So when you get into a for-profit system, you introduce greed and you introduce the possibility of dishonest behavior. So charter schools, though, offer this is the second line of choice.
Absolutely.
And what we have in Florida this year is the voucher system.
Well, we have it in Florida, but other states have already experimented with this idea of vouchers. And it's another thing that I think that on the surface, when you just think about it in theory, it sounds like a great idea. You know,
right.
Okay. So that, as we said earlier, you know, monies are attached to the student, not to the school. So, why shouldn't students be able to go to whatever school they want to go to?
Right.
Whether it's public or private or charter or magnet, whatever the school. And yes, there may be, I guess there may be, lottery systems like there are, we talked about with the magnet and charter schools, but why shouldn't a parent be able to say, I want my kid to go to this school, and that money that's attached to the student go with them to that school? And so we have these voucher systems where, you know, they've done their calculations at the state level and says, well, each student, general education student, is worth this much money. You know, there's this much money attached to that student. Here in Florida, it's about $8,000.
Right. Per year.
Mm-hmm. Per year. And so if a parent chooses to apply and get the voucher, and anybody can apply and get the voucher, the parent can take that $8,000 and apply it to a private school tuition, or they can take their student and put them in another school or try to get them in another school, and that money will go with them to the new school.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Again, on the surface, it sounds like a interesting, good, it could be a good idea, but man, there are so many unintended consequences to this that I don't think that very many people, especially at the state level, are really thinking about.
Right. It sounds so good we're going to give parents a choice. We're going to have choice and we're going to do it. Florida has Florida's right now an experiment because in Florida, any K-12 student can get this $8,000. And it's not just for school tuition. It can be for homeschooling.
Mm-hmm.
And you can take trips and you do field trips and get computers and iPads, and this $8,000 will supplement your efforts in homeschooling. It sounds good. It's like a magnet school. This sounds
right.
Terrific. Sounds like first question that comes up is, we're going to give $8,000 to every student. First of all, are there enough seats in the schools that you want to go to? And the answer to that, of course, is no.
Right.
We're not going to absorb every kid who wants it. Second, this is an income supplement for many families because people are already spending tuition. They have the money to send their kids to private schools. Now they get an $8,000 subsidy because there's no income requirement with this. No matter how much money you make, you get that you can have it. Okay. So what's happening is, I don't know why I want to be careful here because I don't know why we've chosen education. Why we give a family $8,000 to send their child anywhere.
Whatever school.
But if we spend $8,000 per child for health care or $8,000 for food insecurity, it's called welfare. And people don't like that. They don't like government money going for those kinds of programs, but
Right.
they like government money for this.
Right.
You know,
And I think that because you and I have racked our brains with that point so for so long, because to us it just doesn't make sense that that's that education where we choose to do it. But for those listening who just you just want to if we just break it down just a little bit, you think about say like here in Polk County, we have it's a relatively large county here in Central Florida, but let's say that we have 1,000 students in that go to private schools. Right? They don't go to public schools, they go to private schools. And monies that go to schools, monies that come from the state and go to the school are based upon what they call FTE, full-time equivalent. All right. Now, I'm not going to get into I did get the some information from a friend that works in the school district, and the formula is I mean you need upper level calculus to understand the formula and everything on how they break it down. Because it depends on so many different things. But basically, a school is allotted a certain amount of money, a certain number of teacher positions, and all of the stuff based upon the number of students that go to that school. All right. And based upon that, the school district gets the monies from the state and then they allocate it to the different schools. All right. If you have 1,000 students in private school, those students aren't counted as part of the monies that come to the school district. Right, those students are separate because they're not even counted in FTE. They're not on the list when they do the rolls to count how many students go to the different schools and how much money should be allocated. They're not listed in that. They're not included in that list. So if 1,000 parents, and I'm just using 1,000 because there's actually more than 1,000 students in public in private school here in Polk County, but we're just going to use 1,000 of them because it's an easy number. If 1,000 of those parents apply for and get the voucher, that's a thousand families, 1,000 students times $8,000, because each student gets $8,000, that's $8 million, right? 8,000 times 1,000 is $8 million that the school district doesn't have allocated anywhere because those students aren't part of an FTE for any school. That's $8 million extra dollars that the school district has to give out for the voucher program. That doesn't that's over and above what is already allocated to the schools, because again, these students weren't part of the FTE that determine how much money and how much funding the different schools get. So,
So it's not just that they're taking money from,
right.
that's a new account,
That's a new column in
a
the
new expense that the state is saying we will undertake that. Now, this is 1,000 students. We're talking about, we have 100,000 students in our county, more than 100,000 students in Polk County. 10% of them do that.
So you think about how quickly that much money adds up and then try to figure out where it goes and from where it comes, because as you said, you have if you have there's some schools that if 30 or 40 students leave the school to go somewhere else and take, they're going to lose teachers. They're going to, those schools are going to lose teacher positions because they don't have enough students to warrant the number of teachers that they have.
That's right. Let me pause there from because what we're saying is, so there's two problems here. One is you're creating another expense by funding these private school kids. The other problem is let's say you have a school of 500 students and 50 students leave. They take a voucher. The school is underperforming. It's in a bad neighborhood and it's not doing well. So 50 parents pull their kids out of this underperforming school. That's what vouchers intend. We're gonna let you take your kids out of these underperforming schools. Okay. Now that school loses 400, I guess it would be $400,000, almost a half a million dollars, because that $8,000 goes with those 50 kids. So now that school has $400,000 less and 50 fewer students.
Which may
So
mean you lose a teacher.
right. So when they calculate it, they're saying, well, you don't need all these teachers then because you just lost 50 students. Okay. Not only have you lost a half a million dollars, now you've lost a teacher, at least one teacher, maybe more. Okay. So what's happening here is that these students take their money. The parents put them into preferred schools. I guess that's a better way to put it. Preferred schools, high performing schools, which leaves this low performing school with fewer teachers and less money. We call that the Matthew effect, because what's happening here is that Matthew is the Gospel of Matthew. The rich are getting richer and the poor are getting, the good schools are getting better and the poor schools are getting worse. Okay, that's what will happen as we siphon these kids off, whether they go to magnet schools, charter schools, or voucher schools. You're taking the highest performing students out of schools. Well, remember, you're leaving other students behind. And don't forget, this is very good for the people who win the education lottery, whose parents can afford the tuition in excess of 8,000. It's good for them, but remember, we're leaving a bunch of kids behind. Remember, no child left behind, and we're leaving a whole bunch of kids behind because we're leaving them in these underperforming schools.
Absolutely. And so all of this leaves us with a few questions. And one is just that. What happens to the students that don't get a choice? The students that no one wants, the students with behavioral issues, the students who have academic difficulties, the students who have some mental health problems. You know, what happens to those students? Because, you know, even though it's there's, you know, like we talked about with magnet and charter schools, they don't have to keep students if they're not, you know, keeping up or if they're having behavioral issues. And so then they have to go back to their zone school, whether they use the voucher or not. You know, those schools have mandated charters or you know, requirements for students to be there. And either you meet those requirements or you don't. And if you don't, then you can't stay
That's
there.
right. Tell me one preferred school that is going to take a student who has explosive outbursts, emotional meltdowns in a classroom. Give me one school that's going to take that kid. They're not going to take those kids. They're not going to take kids with mental illness. They're not going to take kids with behavior problems. They're not going to take kids who can't pass the state test. Nobody wants those kids. These are our throwaway kids. Nobody wants them. And you say, well, those kids can go to their own school. You know what that's called? That's called a mental hospital. That's called a mental institution. If we put all the kids with mental problems in one school, it's no longer a school. It is a mental institution. It is an institution for people with mental illness. And you're going to concentrate. That's what we did in the 50s and the 60s. We had this concentration of kids who couldn't go. You also watched Forrest Gump. I mean, Forrest Gump couldn't go to the public school because he couldn't walk up the steps. Okay. They were denied an education. And so are we creating the same thing? Because nobody's going to want these kids who can't behave.
And they're, you know, and instead, well, we'll get to solutions probably next week. We
Right.
don't, we're not going to have time today. But so we have this issue of what happens to the students who are underachieving or have behavioral or mental health issues. We have another question. What happens, you know, with these schools of choice? You know, do they have the same standards and requirements and accountability that the other schools have? We know that, again, as you were just saying, that they have that there are some opportunities for them to say, no, we don't want a student who doesn't fit with our scheme, or we don't have a place for a student with some of these academic or behavioral challenges. And so, are their expectations and requirements similar or different? And if they're different, why is that okay?
Right. Bernie, one of the most critical parts of education today are these standardized tests. We have the, they're used for grade placement, they're used for retention, they're used, what courses can you take? Are you allowed to take on it? That's all determined by your performance on these state tests. Private school students don't have to take those. So what is to prevent an education company, a private company, from coming in and saying, we're going to do this, but our students don't have to take those tests? There's no accountability. There's no accountability. There's only accountability for the public schools.
We're gonna punish these kids who don't go to that school by making them take these state tests that could end up in retention or other, consequences, negative consequences for them. But if they go to this other school, then they don't have to worry about that.
They don't have to take that. And I know parents who have done that. I know parents who have money will take their kids out of public school, put them in a private school, and they don't have to worry about the state tests anymore. It's just not an issue.
Another question that we have is about money. We talked about it a few minutes ago, that if 50 students leave a school, that's $400,000 that leaves a school, and then they have so they have not only have less money coming to the school because in suggesting fewer resources, they may potentially lose a teacher, which again is fewer resources. So what happens to the rest of those students? What happens to that school as, usually oftentimes it's the higher achieving, stronger students that are siphoned off. What happens to the rest of them as they're not only are they the students who need support and help left, but they're left in a school with fewer resources to help them?
That's right. And you take $400,000 out of a school, the school's expenses don't decrease. You still have the electric bill, you still have the heating and cooling. You might have to lose a teacher, but a teacher doesn't cost $400,000 a year.
You're not
So
saving that.
you're just taking money out of a school, okay? And you there's no so that, that's what I mean about the poor get poorer. The, these 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 hardworking teachers in these underperforming Title I schools, now you have fewer resources, now you have less money to do your job.
And that leads to sort of our last question, and that is, what about those teachers? Those teachers are left there with students who have more behavioral problems, more educational problems, academic problems, but yet those teachers are paid the same as the teachers, who are at schools where, and I don't want to say te where teaching is easy, but they have students who maybe are more motivated or who have fewer problems. And so, they don't have to, diversify their lessons quite as much. And so teachers in these lower performing or underperforming schools, those teachers have to, maybe teach at four or five different levels because that's the spectrum of students that they have in their classroom. Whereas in these other schools, well, fourth grade is fourth grade. I just teach it like for fourth grade and everybody's there on the same level.
And when we talk about the plight of teachers, imagine this, because this is something nobody thinks about except teachers. Let's say Dr. Bernie and I are both teachers. He teaches at one of these magnet schools where he doesn't have to worry about underachieving students who can't read because those kids get counseled out. He doesn't have to worry about kids throwing desks and having temper tantrums because eventually those kids will be removed. I teach at a poor in a poor school. I don't have that choice. I have got to figure out a way to deal with these kids who are having meltdowns, aggressive outbursts, underachieving. He and I make the same salary.
Well, and in fact, I may get a little bit more because my students are doing so well that I'm going to get some incentive pay
That's right.
because I'm going to be seen as highly effective, not because I'm doing anything special, but because my students are more motivated and they're more driven to do the work.
That's right. My job is more dangerous. My job takes more time. My job takes more. I don't have parental involvement. I have a lot of kids who are in poverty, who aren't eating, who aren't sleeping well. Bernie has just the opposite. He has a parent involvement. Everybody's motivated. They all want to be there. They're doing their darndest to stay in that school.
Right.
My students are doing their darndest to get out of school. High absentee rates, low morale. And yet we make this. Imagine what that does to teacher morale.
Absolutely.
When I'm watching you, we go out and have a beer together, and you tell me about your work day, and then I tell you about my work day. That's demoralizing for teachers.
Sure.
The inequity is demoralizing. So we have to think, when we talk about the plight of teachers, we need to think about these policy decisions and what their long-term effect, what their unintended consequences might be.
Absolutely. So, and we'll wrap up there for this week. Next week we'll get into some ideas for some solutions, some maybe some potential paths for us to follow from here, because it is a all of that is going to be on the systems level. Individual schools can't make change when it comes to some of this stuff. So, we'll kind of talk a little bit about that next week, because what all of this has done is it certainly has created that two-tiered education system that we've talked about before, where you have schools that perform at a very high level, almost just by existing, because of the students that are in there. They don't necessarily even have to do anything extra. It's just that because of their student population, because of their magnet status or their charter, they have students who do very well. Then you have class schools that are less than a mile away, who aren't school of choice, and they're performing very poorly.
Right.
Geographically, they're right next door, but there's a significant difference. And so, it's created this two-tier system where those that, as you said, those that are high achieving, they continue to do well, and those that are not doing well, they continue to not do well. And we're not really doing anything to balance that. So,
Right. And it leaves this second tier that I'm worried about, because I'm not worried about the kids who are in these really high performing schools. Those kids are, they're going to do fine. Okay. I'm worried about all these kids in this second tier, this lower tier. Who's taking care of them? Who's addressing their needs? And the other question is, why are we tolerating why should we have a low performing school?
right.
Has anybody even thought about that? Is it why is this school performing at this level? Who's addressing those issues?
Right.
Choice doesn't address those issues.
Right.
Choice creates really good schools at one level, at the top tier. It's being done at, I think, at the expense of the second tier, and we need to address those kinds of issues.
Absolutely. And we will touch on that next week. So until then, stay happy, stay healthy, and forget to be afraid.